Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Seeing heading in all six reporting states.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey on the rice crop.
19% headed nationally, 5 points ahead of the five-year average of 14%, ahead of last year's 17%. The range is from 4% headed in top producer Arkansas and also in Missouri, all the way up to 66% in early planting Louisiana. Rice condition has actually improved, generally speaking, over the last week. 80% of the crop, 4/5, now rated good to excellent. That's an improvement from last week's 78%. Just 2% of the crop, very poor to poor, no change from last week. And we're getting close to last year's lofty numbers. A year ago at this time, we were sitting at 82% good to excellent and 3% very poor to poor.
This is Agriculture Today.
A potential strike at Tyson Foods' Amarillo beef processing plant appears to have been avoided. Union leaders with Teamsters Local 577 say a labor agreement's been reached. The facility is Tyson's largest beef processing plant, employs more than 3,000 workers. Strike would have had significant implications for cattle markets, processing capacity, and downstream supply chains. Now, according to the Teamsters Local 577, proposed four-year contract includes immediate and structured wage increases. In year one, base wages would rise by $4 per hour, retroactive to hours worked after the expiration of the previous agreement. Production heavy skill jobs would see a $5 raise at ratification. Maintenance positions at level 7 and above receive a $4.50 increase. An additional raise is scheduled for each of the next 3 years, 50 cents in year 2, 70 cents year 3, 90 cents in year 4. Agreement also outlines a ratification bonus scaled by years of service ranging from $250 to $1,000 per year. Other benefits in the proposal include paid jury duty, bereavement leave, and updated vacation eligibility. And workers receive 1 week of vacation after 6 months, another week after 1 year, 2 weeks at the 3-year mark, and 4 weeks after 10 years of service. USDA beginning a phased reopening of the live cattle trade with Mexico following a temporary suspension last month due to screwworm concerns. Officials say the port of entry at Douglas, Arizona will be the first to resume operations. Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins identified the site as a low-risk area for New World screwworm, allowing trade to restart under controlled conditions. Texas Ag Commissioner Sid Miller and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association backing the decision, calling it a science-based approach, protecting U.S. livestock without harming producers unduly. Additional ports in New Mexico and Texas could reopen in the coming weeks, depending on the outcomes at the Arizona location. U.S. cattle feeders and backgrounders have closely followed the developments given the impact of Mexican feeder cattle on the domestic supply chain. The reopening marks a cautious step forward after USDA closed the border to prevent potential screwworm outbreaks from entering the U.S. herd. New USDA data shows that commercial farms continue to hold the largest share of total farm sector debt, despite making up the smallest share of U.S. farms by number. In 2023, commercial farms held 69% of all farm debt, up from 45% in 1996. The increase reflects the higher capital demands of large-scale operations, which often require outside financing for equipment, land, and advanced technology. Meanwhile, intermediate and residential farms have seen their debt shares decline. Residential farm debt peaked around 27% in 2003, but fell to just 13% by 2023. Intermediate farms declined from 36% to 18% over the same period. And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Chair Powell, you said last week that conflict in the Middle East in the 1970s resulted in very large inflation shocks.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell at the semiannual monetary policy review before the House Financial Services Committee with Connecticut Representative Jim Himes.
In contrast to the 1970s, today the United States does not import most of its energy. We call ourselves energy self-sufficient on a net basis. But I hear the argument made that I think is wrong, that because we're energy self-sufficient, somehow we are insulated from global energy price market prices. Can you comment on that? Is there any validity to the notion that we are not, American consumers of energy are not subject to global swings in energy prices?
Yeah, so the price of oil is set globally, right? And I think if you go back a few years, the thought was that when the global we had a natural shock absorber, which is that we would just drill more, and that we would, if prices went up, we would drill more, and so you wouldn't have these sustained price shocks that we had during the 1970s and the original OPEC era. I think that is actually in question now because the oil industry in the U.S. is being much more careful and focused on return on investment than they were, having been burned with overcapacity.
Right, and I mean, yeah, in the long run, you can invest in additional extraction technologies, but this does not respond to day-to-day spot prices. So
not quickly.
The point I'm trying to make is that the conflict in the Middle East, if it resulted in $120 barrel oil, which is where oil was in 2022, that would have a fairly substantial inflationary impact on the American household. Is that correct?
We would certainly feel that, and as we discussed earlier, there's a lot of lore around looking through oil price shocks, but that depends on the facts and circumstances.
What, as a technical matter, we tend to refer to CPI, which is a basket of goods, and we measure the price changes. Roughly speaking, what percentage of that basket is comprised of energy?
I don't have that on the top of my head. It's much less than it was, of course. The oil consumption is much less than it was in the 70s as a percent of GDP.
But energy includes natural gas and gasoline, and that's it's a meaningful portion of the.
Yes, although of course we have more natural gas than we have so much natural gas, so that'll always be there for us.
So none of us can predict what's going to happen in the Middle East in an hour, much less in a week or a month or a year. But as a technical matter, at what price for a barrel of oil does the American household begin to feel inflationary effects? So we're at $75 a barrel roughly right now. At what price point does the American household begin to feel some inflationary effects?
I don't want to throw out a number. I think we're frankly, it's too early to say that something like that's going to happen. And I know you know that, but I wouldn't want to throw out a specific number. If prices went up materially, people would feel that.
Again, I think if I look at the data here, WTI per barrel, about 120, it peaked at about $120 in 2022. What do your models suggest would occur to inflation, and how would it influence the Fed's thinking should we be back at $120 a barrel?
Well, let's just say there's a big price spike in that range. So, we would look at that, and we would ask ourselves, we look at the overall situation, we would ask ourselves, should we react to that? So, for example, during what we call the Arab Spring back in the early teens, oil prices went up a lot, and that went into the price, and there was a discussion, and I think the right answer was to look through that. The question you'd be asking to yourself, because by the time you react, the price comes back down. I think the question today would be, is the situation different, and what would be the implications of those differences?
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Today we'll be examining Farm Bill conservation programs and hearing from a distinguished panel of witnesses from their perspectives.
Chairman of a House Ag Subcommittee on Conservation Research and Biotech and former chairman of the House Ag Committee, Frank Lucas from Oklahoma.
Title II of the Farm Bill authorizes a suite of conservation programs that are critical for supporting the long-term viability of farmers, ranchers, and rural communities. These programs have the dual benefit of supporting the producer and addressing pressing national natural resource concerns at the local level.
Ranking member of the committee from Hawaii, Jill Takuda.
As ranking member, I'm proud to join you and our colleagues in reaffirming a shared commitment to supporting America's farmers, ranchers, and producers through smart, effective conservation policy. I also want to thank our panel of witnesses for being here today and extend an especially warm mahalo to Nicole Galase for traveling all the way, I think she came the farthest, all the way from Hawaii to share the perspective of food producers operating in some of the most remote and climate-vulnerable parts of the country. Now, let's begin with some common ground. USDA conservation programs work, whether it's EQIP, CSP, ACEP, RCPP, the whole alphabet soup of acronyms. These programs provide practical tools to improve soil health, manage water more efficiently, and keep operations productive and resilient. But here's a hard truth. The weather isn't what it used to be, no matter what you want to call it. Climate change, extreme weather, shifting seasons. Our producers are living it every day. Longer droughts, harder rains, heat waves in April, frost in May. It's getting harder to grow the food, fuel, and fiber that this country relies on. And that's not a partisan talking point. It's reality for farmers and ranchers across this country. Programs like EQIP and CSIP can help producers adapt, but they've been chronically underfunded for decades, turning away thousands of qualified farmers each year, not because the programs don't work, but because demand far exceeds supply. That's why the Inflation Reduction Act was such a turning point. The conservation investments in the IRA weren't just a budget line, they were a statement, a bold, time-limited, once-in-a-generation effort to meet demand head-on and finally give producers the access and the technical support they need to take on the challenges they're facing today. Now, yes, we've seen bills that move IRA dollars into the baseline USDA conservation budget, and that is a good thing. And on the surface, that might look like a step towards stability, but let's not lose sight of what made the IRA conservation funding different and powerful. The IRA wasn't about business as usual. It was about breaking the logjam. It opened the floodgates to let more farmers and more ranchers get the support they've been asking for many, many years. And let me be clear, this is not about left or right, it's about forward. Whether you're in red states, blue states, purple states, or farm country right in between, producers are not asking for politics, they're asking for access, for flexibility, for conservation tools that make their land more resilient, their water more efficient, and their operations more secure, because their livelihoods, as you all know, depend on it, and so does our nation's food supply. So as we move forward, whether a farm bill or broader conservation planning, let's protect not just the dollars, but the spirit behind what was in the IRA. Urgency, scale, and the recognition that changing conditions require bold action, not modest tweaks. So let's make sure that in the name of stability, we don't slip back into scarcity. Our producers don't need diluted promises. They need real, timely, farmer-focused support, because the weather's not waiting, and neither should we. I look forward to our dialogue today and to working with this committee to continue improving the effectiveness of NRCS programs, supporting our staff, and supporting Americans' agriculture through thoughtful and innovative conservation practices.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
First off, to see our chart over the last 20 years, we have generally seen growth in exports and growth in imports.
Brad Lubin is an ag economist at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
Yes, we're a major agricultural producer in the world, and we're a major exporter of those ag products. We also are the number one consumer market in the world, and we're a major importer of many ag products as well. Often, maybe most of the time, those are complementary products. We export grains and we export meat and we import coffee and other exotic fruits and so forth. Sometimes they appear to be competing products. We actually export beef and import beef at the same time. Well, but it is different. We export higher value cuts. We tend to import lean trim that complements our ground beef production in the U.S. But what we have seen here is that exports have actually fallen back in the last couple of years. 23 and 24 have fallen back from the record of 22. Imports, however, have continued to push higher. And we actually have a rather sizable trade deficit, even in agriculture, which is one of the sectors we historically always said was one of the few U.S. sectors that ran a trade surplus. Well, right now we're running a trade deficit. And some of the challenges we see with U.S. exports and trade policy don't really tell a better tale of this going forward. So it's a thumbs down at the moment until we see better signs of what's going on in the trade front.
That's trade. But what about the ag economy? Mark Edelman, ag economist, Iowa State.
I have a great deal of confidence that the Federal Reserve as long as it's allowed to remain independent in making its decisions, that it will successfully manage the general economy. My real concern is focused on the ag economy, and I think the ag economy, we need to get to work. We need to get to work on getting the trade deals done, and we need to get to work to allow biofuels the capacity to utilize domestically what we're producing. And I think that's basically who we're selling to is our food customers, our fuel customers, and our international trade customers. And right now, we aren't expanding the population very fast domestically. And so when you hear words that we need to sell more domestically, we're talking about, well, let's look at fuels. And we can produce some additional biofuels for sustainable aviation fuel going forward, and that would certainly help the sector out tremendously. And we need to get those rabbits pulled out of the hat on trade to get the trade markets up there.
And Jenny Ift is an ag economist at Kansas State.
I'll start with the macroeconomy. I think overall we're coming from a place of strength and resilience, notwithstanding the long-term challenge with the federal spending and deficit. Definitely some short-term challenges as well with uncertainty around trade and GDP. On the farm sector side, there definitely is a lot of resilience, and the livestock sector is generally doing pretty well. That's cyclical. I do worry about where crop farms are, and I know the financial situation is a real mixed bag. You know, there's more established producers or producers that have managed to build up some liquidity over the past years who are prepared to weather the storm. But I know in Kansas and other states, we've also seen some farms that have had financial difficulties in the last few years. And I did look at 2025 forecast farm income. And even with the government payments, it looks like debt repayment is going to be an issue for a lot of corn, soybean, and wheat farm businesses. So there are indicators of financial stress out there with liquidity. And again, it's a very mixed bag. But you combine that with the market and trade uncertainty, I think that there are some definitely some real headwinds out there. And, you know, like Brad and Mark said, hopefully some of these trade deals materialize and we get to a more stable position.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My constituents, who you suggest I'll hear from, are unfortunately getting misleading information about the bill. In particular, people who would be, quote, kicked off of Medicaid.
At a recent House Budget Committee hearing on rooting out waste and fraud and restoring the dignity of work, the chairman of the House Budget Committee from Texas, Jody Arrington.
There's been misleading statements and fear-mongering galore about the safety net, quote, being ripped out from under our most vulnerable, disabled veterans, sick, pregnant mothers, etc. I think personally, and I'm not directing this just at you, but I'm, as the Democrat witness, I'm telling you, it's a gross mischaracterization. That's polite. That's polite language. And I think it's preying on vulnerable people to say that. So what I did was because the statements have been around CBO, the independent nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office's analysis or statement of the 7.8 million people who would be without Medicaid as a result of the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill as it was passed out of the House. But I needed more information, so I sent a letter along with Chairman Guthrie. Who are those 7.8 million people being, quote, kicked off of Medicaid? Well, I've got the letter here. This is the same nonpartisan, independent CBO that was referenced by my Democrat colleagues. And they state very clearly that the 7.8 million people are people who are able to work who refuse to work, legally ineligible, but we don't do or haven't done the sort of program integrity implementation and enforcement like verifying people's eligibility, or they qualify for some other government-subsidized health insurance, or 1.5 million people are here illegally and should not benefit from taxpayer-funded social services. We're having a tough time with $36 trillion in debt, $2 trillion in annual deficits, $1 trillion in interest, and a future insolvent Social Security trust fund along with Medicare and the list of disastrous concerns into the future on fiscal sustainability of these programs continues. But that's it. They literally say, CBO estimates that enacting Medicaid provisions in Title IV, the H.R. 1, the Big Beautiful Bill Act, will increase the number of people without health insurance by 7.8 million by 2034. Of that number, 4.8 million are people who are able to work who refuse to work. Of that 7.8, 1.5 million almost are here illegally. 1.6 million are ineligible or are eligible for another government-subsidized health insurance and refuse to get it. So we need to set the record straight. I've taken enough time. Anyone can read this for themselves. We sent the letter requesting this information June 18th. We just got it yesterday, June 24th. I encourage everybody not to submit it for the record without objection. So ordered.
Chairman of the House Budget Committee from Texas, Jody Arrington. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
My son-in-law owned a farm together we bought a few years ago, which, by the way, the neighboring farmer that plants it uses no-till, so we try to address soil good soil practices.
Representative Mark Mesmer from Indiana, a member of the House Ag Subcommittee on Conservation, Research, and Biotechnology.
To address some drainage and erosion problems, we put in drain tile and had some earthen dams built. While it solved the erosion and runoff issues, it bore a hefty price tag, and it'll take us about 3 years from the cash rent to pay off the upgrades that we put on that property.
Illinois Representative and member of the House Ag Committee, Nikki Budzinski.
My district is the home to some of the most productive soil in the world. In the last census of agriculture, multiple counties in my district were in the top 15 corn and soybean producing counties in the entire country. And the farmers in my district are extremely driven to protect that valuable resource, especially as we see increased frequency of severe weather. Over the last few years, my district has seen dry enough drought conditions that we had a fatal dust storm along Interstate 55, as well as several tornadoes, severe flooding, and a derecho that hit the Springfield community as well. Severe weather events like these increase the risk of agricultural operations across the country and threaten long-term soil health. That's why USDA conservation programs are so important to my district. They can help reduce risk on the farm, protect soil and crops for our farmers, and improve water and air quality for all of us. With that in mind, I want to talk about how we can help farmers access the critical programs to reduce the risk of their operations. Just an example, in Illinois at the state level, we have the Cover Crops Premium Discount Program that allows a $5 per acre premium discount on crop insurance for acres where cover crops are planted. This is a great program that many farmers have taken advantage of, but $5 an acre is certainly below the cost of adoption for cover crops. Mr. Fink, if I could ask you this question, I know that American Farmland Trust has been active in uplifting conservation practices as a part of risk management. In your opinion, how could the federal crop insurance program be updated to better reflect proven risk-reducing properties of conservation?
Thank you for that question, Congresswoman. I'll say first and foremost, we need to make sure that the crop insurance system is not conflicting with these good farming practices. There's been a lot of progress on that front. There's still probably more progress to be made. I think the other aspect is that when we look at the crop insurance system, if we're talking about creating additional incentives, it's something that has to be actuarially sound. And the good news is when we look at cover crop adoption, we've seen a lot of the research, it is reducing overall indemnity payments in the face of a lot of these extreme weather events. It's also reducing prevent planting payments. And so whatever we can do that looks at the actuarial soundness, builds the research to make that case, and ultimately our goal is to reward farmers for practices that are saving the public money and saving themselves money.
Great, thank you. And maybe just a follow-up question for any of the panelists. If you could share how conservation practices have reduced risk for you or members of your organization, I'd love to hear about that as well.
Some of the most important conservation practices that have been funded have been things like invasive species removal to reduce fire fuel loads and cutting fire breaks. Mm-hmm. This is protecting not only the ranch and the producer, but the community around the ranch, which makes them a good neighbor, it helps their business, and it's better for the planet.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Overall warmth across much of the nation's corn-growing areas is reflected in improved crop condition per USDA's Crop Progress Report for the period ending June 29th. According to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey,
condition numbers now at 73% good to excellent. That's up 3 points from the previous week. 5% very poor to poor. That is down a point from last week. And we only have 4 states out of 18 reporting states where those very poor to poor ratings are into double digits.
With those 4 states, Colorado, Tennessee, North Dakota, and Indiana, barely over double-digit very poor-to-poor condition for their crops.
That's another way of saying that across the board, things are really looking pretty good for this 2025 corn crop as we head into the month of July.
Corn silking progress as of June 29th was recorded at 8%, 2 points behind last year. I'm Rod Bain reporting for in Washington, D.C.